Our next speaker is Deborah Lipstadt, who is the Daroch Professor of Modern Jewish History and Holocaust Studies at Emory University, where she created the Tam Institute for Jewish Studies. Among her publications are Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, History on Trial, My Day in Court with a Holocaust Denier, The Eichmann Trial, and Holocaust and American Understanding. She's currently writing a new book, Contemporary Antisemitism, How New, How Different, How Dangerous. At Emory, she directs the website HDOT, Holocaust Denial on Trial, which archives all the documentary evidence of her trial and other information on Holocaust denial. She was appointed by President Obama to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council. She chairs the U.S. Holocaust Museum's Committee on Antisemitism and state-sponsored Holocaust denial. Welcome to Deborah Lipstadt.
I'm going to give a low-tech presentation. First of all, it is a privilege to be here. I had to change around the schedule in order to be able to participate, but I did so gladly and willingly because I recognize the importance of this gathering. It was, if you allow me 1 minute, and don't start the clock yet, 1 minute of recollection. It was about a year after my book, Holocaust Denial, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, came out, that I received a call from someone I didn't know at that point named Peter Balakian, who told me about this outrageous situation at Princeton with Professor Lowry, and asked me to get involved. And I worked together, I had the privilege of working together with Robert J. Lifton on preparing material and talking about denial, writing stuff in the New York Times, giving testimony or submitting testimony to the Congress, et cetera. So this is something that has been, sadly, the issue of Armenian genocide denial, something which I have hovered at the periphery, academically, but more so in my heart, not at the periphery at all. What I'd like to do today is to highlight some of the basic premises, tactics, and strategic objectives of Holocaust denial. And I think you will hear both the Asa's paper, Jennifer's paper, and papers, some of the papers we heard yesterday, resonance of Armenian genocide denial. But I begin with a cautionary observation, which is more applicable to Holocaust denial than I think Armenian genocide denial. And that is that I do not see Holocaust denial as a clear and present danger. There are far more individuals engaged in worldwide study of the Holocaust than in denial. And I think that hardcore denial, the denial of the facts, was seriously wounded by the lawsuit, which I'll mention again later, but the case brought against me by David Irving in the United Kingdom, where he sued me for libel for calling him a Holocaust denier. I think that research done by the magnificent historians we had as our expert witnesses really helped decimate the instance of Holocaust denial, and I would think that there's something there to be learned in fighting Armenian genocide denial, particularly some of the more recent and some of the people mentioned this morning by Asa. Now, Holocaust denial may have implications for the future. It is possible that it can come back in a stronger fashion, particularly since deniers have become very adept, as many others have as well, at use of the internet. But again, I'm not standing here saying, dear me, the sky is falling. I think it's a very different situation with the two genocides. Now, what are the basic premises of traditional Holocaust denial? I go through them quite quickly. There was no attempt by the Third Reich to wipe out the Jews of Europe and beyond. Some Jews may have suffered, you have to pay attention to line, suffered, but and even were killed, but they were not singled out for mass annihilation. Hitler's Germany was not the instigator of World War II. The responsibility for the war must be shared with the Allies and even more so with the Jews. Those Jews who were incarcerated in concentration camps were placed there by Germans for their own protection. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it was argued in the High Court in London by David Irving. The number 6 million is an exaggeration that was fabricated by Jews in the post-war period. The number of Jews actually killed by the Nazis and their allies is at most equal to, but probably smaller than, the number of German civilians who were killed in Allied war bombings. Gas chambers are a scientific impossibility. If someone just walked in now and heard me saying this, this is what deniers say. I saw someone just walk in, I got a little nervous. People who purport to be survivors of the concentration camps are sociopaths, liars, or doing this, again, to quote David Irving, for the money. There are other arguments that are made, but these are sort of the basic one. Now, how do they go about this? They try to explain away the evidence. They offer in the face of what we would see as indisputable evidence, they offer non-sinister explanations, again, similar to what some of the things we heard this morning. For instance, the supposed gas chambers at Auschwitz were in fact air raid shelters. Now, of course, the fact that they were a kilometer away, the ones in Birkenau, if you've been there, they're a kilometer away, as Professor Lauer knows well, from where the SS was housed. So came an air raid shelter, you'd have to gear up, put all your stuff on, came an air raid, put all your stuff on, and jog a kilometer to these air raid shelters, of course, makes no sense. They could not have been air raid shelters for the inmates because they simply weren't large enough. Or Zyklon Bay. Zyklon Bay was used for fumigation. Well, it was used for fumigation in the camp, but you can, as Professor Robert Jan van Pelt has done, you can track the spikes in ordering of Zyklon Bay with the exact spikes of deportations and annihilations at the camp. Terms such as Ausrotten, to root out, which is one of the words Nazi officials, German officials used for the extermination, for the annihilation, are really benign, have been given sinister explanations by Jews. And when evidence cannot be contested, such as the case of the Einsatzgruppen reports, which were detailed and extensive and sent first on a daily and then a weekly basis during the mass, those were the mobile killing units that did the mass shootings in the Soviet Union, these Jews were being killed because they were partisans, because they were criminals, etc. Of course, when you have a category for partisans and partisans and criminals, and you have a category for Jews, and the one for Jews is maybe 1,200, and that's 30,000, but again, that's one of the arguments they give. Now, what are some of their tactics? And I thought of this during Jennifer's paper. They will demand one particular document. Show me the Hitler order. Now, of course, there are many ways of responding to this. The deniers would say, if there was such an order, it would have been found. It wasn't found, so obviously there was no program. Now, first of all, no historian that I know of bases a whole argument on the basis of one document. And if you do, you don't give undue weight to one document, especially when there is so much other documentation to go along with this, proving the existence of the Holocaust. But this is something they will focus on. Or they will engage in what I call immoral equivalencies. When I once had the dubious pleasure of visiting Robert Faurisson in his home in Vichy, he was very proud of the fact that he was in Vichy. He told me, he started out by saying, war is awful, all groups engage in bad things, people do awful things in war, so everyone is guilty. David Irving does that a lot, another denier. I cite David Irving, well, first of all, I have a personal connection with him. Second of all, because he was the source for many years of the historical arguments. He either repeated them, finessed them, or created them. But he said, he would often say, well, yes, we can believe that maybe 60,000 Jews died, not murdered, died at Auschwitz, but that's the same number that died in a bombing in Hamburg or something like that. They will also engage in what I call perpetrator, and we heard some of this again this morning, perpetrator-victim inversion. It was the Germans who endured terrible things, first by the bombings, and then, of course, being forced to accept guilt for something they didn't do at Nuremberg. They'll use even-handed language. So when you have death books showing Jews having died at Auschwitz, they'll say died, not murdered, that kind of thing. And then they will attack important but seemingly small sources. They spend a lot of effort attacking the diary of Anne Frank. Now you would think, why attack the diary of a 13, 14-year-old? Well, of course, because if you ask many students, ask your students in your classes, what was the first book they ever read in the Holocaust? It's the diary of Anne Frank. So Bradley Smith, falsus in unum, falsus in omnibus. If I can prove this is false, everything is false. Say they will do that. They sometimes spend more energy trying to do that than disproving gas chambers, some of them. In fact, it got so bad that the Dutch archives, which is in possession, to which Otto Frank gave the diary, put out about 800-page book, the critical edition of the diary, and subjected the diary to forensic tests, paper tests, ink, handwriting, showed the different versions, all as a way of responding to deniers. They will also attack influential sources, and this reminded me of the attack on the paper we heard this morning about the attack on Morgenthau. They spend a lot of time attacking Elie Wiesel, trying to find every little mistake, everything they can say about him. In fact, they generally call him Elie Wiesel, as a way, again, of showing their contempt. But so they can instill doubts and make him a questionable witness. Or they will do something, again, I thought of it this morning, I didn't include it in the paper, what I call the yes but syndrome. Yes, the Holocaust happened, but the Jews deserved it. Yes, it happened, but it wasn't so bad. Yes, it happened, but what happened to the Germans was even worse. That yes but syndrome, and they use it very frequently. Now, how do you respond? There are many ways, of course, of responding. One of the ways, and I would argue that this is maybe something worth doing with some of the people mentioned this morning, is what the strategy that was used at my trial when I was on trial for libel, having been sued by David Irving for calling him a Holocaust denier, and of course it was in the UK, where the burden of proof is on the defendant to prove the truth of what she said, unlike in the United States, where the burden of proof is on the plaintiff to prove the falsehood of what was written. So I had to prove the truth. If I hadn't fought him, which many people told me, including some leading Holocaust historians, I shouldn't waste my time doing that, he would have won by default. Had he won by default, his version, which I sort of alluded to earlier with the premises of Holocaust deniers, would have been accepted by the court as legitimate, because I would have been held for libel, committed libel by calling him a denier. What did we do? We followed the footnotes. We followed the footnotes back to the sources. You can go to www.hdotholocaustdenialontrial.org. It's in every website, but it has its own portal because they're afraid I'm going to bring down the whole university. I told them the Yerkes Primate Center is more likely to do that, but they weren't interested in hearing that. But it's what Richard Evans, Christopher Browning, Robert Jan van Pelt, and Peter Longarisha, a dream team of historians who were all expert witnesses in my case, did. So they took everything David Irving said about the Holocaust, followed it back to its original source, to its primary document, and to demonstrate that he lied, he made up. Let me quote from Richard Evans. Not one of his books, speeches, or articles, not one paragraph, not one sentence in any of them can be taken on trust as an accurate representation of the historical subject. All of them are completely worthless as history because Irving cannot be trusted anywhere in all of them to give a reliable account of what he is talking about. It may seem, and this is, again, also this may be, I was thinking about this when you were speaking, it may seem an absurd semantic dispute to deny the appellation of historian to someone who has written 24 books or more about historical subjects. But if we mean by historian someone who is concerned to discover the truth about the past and to give as accurate representation of it as possible, then Irving is not a historian. It took tedious work going back to the footnotes, but this is what we demonstrated. I have an example in here. I don't have time to really go into it, but what he did in one case, I'll do it very briefly. There was on April 16th, 17th, 1943, the war's at its height. Foreign Minister Ribbentrop and Hitler meet with Admiral Horthy, who's the head of the Hungarian government. They are upset with the Hungarians because the Hungarians have not agreed to the deportation of the Jews. They have treated the Jews very badly, but they have refused to go as far as deporting them. The Hungarian Jews are murdered till the Germans come in March of 44, and that happens very quickly in a space of about 7 weeks. Over 400,000 Jews are murdered. But this is before that. So they've put pressure on them. We have a minute of the meeting, notes on the meeting. And on the first day, Horthy says, "What do you expect me to do to deport the Jews that they should die like beasts in the field?" And Hitler says, "No, that's not necessary." On the second day of the meeting, Horthy asks the same question, and Hitler launches into a murderous harangue. Blood is dripping from every word. The Jews are like tuberculous bacilli. They must be eliminated. Even the smallest, youngest animal, a baby animal that carries something, must be put down. It's a prescription for murder. Ribbentrop says they must be taken to concentration camps, they must be killed or taken to concentration camps and allowed to die. How does Irving handle this? He switches the sequence of the 2 days. So he has the meeting beginning with Hitler's harangue, but he has the second day, Hitler's statement made on the first day, "No, that's not necessary," when Horthy asked the question. And he buries Ribbentrop's statement in it, deep into a footnote. But by switching sequence, and sometimes he does much worse, but here just simply switching sequence, he gives the reader a very different impression of what was happening. Then he does something else, which I missed completely when I first encountered it. He says, of course, in his author's voice, sort of explaining why this issue was so important, of getting the Jews out of Budapest, of having them deported. He says, of course, this was the time of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, which, of course, is the next week, is the anniversary of that uprising. Hitler was concerned about all the troops retreating from the east who were giving their weapons to the Jews in the ghetto. And I don't know of any troops retreating from the east that were stopping at the ghetto and handing over their weapons. But more importantly, this meeting took place on the 16th and 17th of April. The uprising started on the 19th. And it wasn't like Hitler knew, oh, in 2 days we're having the uprising and it's going to be problematic. So just by that sleight of hand, he gives a very different impression what happened. Now, one of the things, to move from that example and to somewhat get through this, one of the things I do with my students, and even before we go into documents, is I say for the deniers to be right, who has to be wrong? Well, certainly the perpetrators. That's usually the last one they'll come to. So I'm sorry, the first one they'll say, of course, is the witnesses. And they'll say, and so we talk about witness statement memoirs. I know there's a session on this tomorrow, evidence. And I was struck by something I used to say to them, but then when I was reading Salman Rushdie's memoir and his years in hiding, he recalled, and I don't have it, I have it here someplace, but he was told by a British policeman that, because what the deniers will do is focus on small differences. We got off the train and we turned left, and we were standing in front of Mengele. We got off the train and we turned right and we were standing in front of Mengele. Well, left, right, first of all, it was a traumatic moment. The arrivals in Birkenau were designed to be traumatic. Number three, as Robert Jan van Pelt told me when we visited Birkenau in preparation for the trial, that the tracks were extended into the camp to facilitate the Hungarian murder, and people got off the train from the two ends and went to where the doctors, Mengele or whoever it was, standing in the middle. So some did get off and turn right, and some did get off and turn left. But what I wanted to quote from Rushdie's recollection was where a policeman told them, if a witnesses give the exact same rendition without any variation, we know they're lying, or they've been prepared. And if you think a moment of trauma, et cetera, but this is what deniers will often focus on, the witnesses. Of course, they will also focus on the bystanders, the people in the towns around Treblinka, who Lanzmann interviewed, who went into the watched the trains going in day after day, coming out empty, or the train conductor in Shoah, who, when he's asked what happened to the people, he makes that famous sign. But of course, the perpetrators. There's never been any a World War II war crimes trial in which a defendant has said it didn't happen. They said, "I didn't do it. I was forced to do it. I didn't have the chance, you know, to say no, et cetera, et cetera. But never that it didn't happen. Or Germans, well, of course, deniers will say the reason Adenauer acknowledged that it happened, or the Germans that acknowledged that they happened, this was the only way for Germany to be accepted back into the family of nations. So they have answers. They're slippery. They quote one another. It's a merry-go-round. But again, it's necessary to break down and look at what they're doing. Finally, the last point I want to make is, of course, the idea that Holocaust denial, at its roots, is related to anti-Semitism. It is the notion that this small group of Jews managed to perpetrate this great hoax on the world in order to get two things. It's normally said, you know, Israel was a result of the Holocaust. I don't think that's historically correct. The Peel Commission in 1936 was already talking about establishing something, but that's for another conference. But and the second thing is reparations, which is a fancy word for money. So right there you have the two basic points of any anti-Semitic charge. Jews manipulate, poison the wells, desecrate the hosts, do blood libels. They go against the weak, they go against the defenseless for their own benefit, and particularly financial benefit. My argument would be that, you know, that is one of the reasons if Holocaust denial has any traction, it has that traction, plus this, again, what we heard from others yesterday and today, this overlay of seemingly academic kinds of tactics or presentations. And it's not, if you look back, by the way, deniers, and again, I think, I don't know if this applies in terms of the Armenian genocide, but certainly applies in terms of racism and white racist supremacists. Deniers, when they first showed up on the scene, by and large, were neo-Nazis, dressed in Nazi-like uniforms, their publications full of swastikas and Heil Hitlers and all that. In the mid-70s, that changed. With the creation of the Institute for Historical Review in Newport Beach, and scholarly sounding conferences, scholarly looking publications, and they began to call themselves revisionists. We're not deniers. We are trying to revise mistakes in history. Revisionism is something that is an accepted, it's what we all do as historians. We look at the past and we try to figure out a new way or a different way or a better way we think of understanding it. And it's that kind of argument, posing of arguments that I see that resonates so loudly with me in terms of what we now see with the Armenian genocide denial, with planting of professors in influential places, publications. Oh, we're just trying to understand Professor Morgenthau's diary. We've got to follow the footnotes and go back to this. There have been those, the last point I want to make, and with this I close, there have been those who have argued for laws against Holocaust denial, genocide denial, in what the editor at the Washington Post described when I told him that I was against them, as in the ultimate man bites dog story. I don't believe in those laws because I think they suggest we don't have the historical information to prove this. If there had been such a law, we would never have had to fight the case we did. It was very expensive and very time-consuming. It took 6 or 7 years of my life. But we managed in that way to really devastate deniers. But having said that and recognizing that foolish inconsistencies are the hobgoblins of small minds, at the same time, I can understand why a Germany and Austria, Poland, and certain other countries would have such laws. So it's a tricky kind of notion. But I think the best way of fighting denial, whether it's Armenian genocide denial, whether it's Holocaust denial, whether it's a genocides that here on this continent is by what we do and what you do and what you have done is bringing together scholars, and whether we're following the footnotes, sharing ideas, exploring new fields, I think that's the best way of answering deniers and ensuring that others don't pick up the poison. Thank you very much.